We're now almost 6 months into the war on Gaza. Over 30,000 people have been killed, and 2 million people are at risk of a man-made famine. It's a situation which has rightly generated a lot of anger across the world. In Britain, at least, it's led to hundreds of thousands of people to protest.
Hundreds of thousands gathered in Hyde Park, then spilled into Park Lane. A mass of people filling some of London's widest streets for 3 miles as they walked to the US Embassy, crossing Vauxhall Bridge.
I was on that particular demonstration, and while we were there for undeniably grim reasons, there was something that was still uplifting about the day. The protest was so crowded that it took 2 hours to shuffle along just 500 metres of Park Lane. And I spent that time surrounded by families who'd travelled from all across the country, wanting to let it be known that they opposed the killing of other innocent families by a close ally of the UK. But that's not how everyone framed it.
To my mind, there's only one way to describe those marches. They are hate marches.
Within 2 weeks of making that claim, Suella Braverman would be out of her job as Home Secretary. But the targeting of the marches would continue. And parts of the British right-wing press left no doubt as to why they found the marches so troubling.
This is what we saw on Saturday evening in Whitehall. Outside, number 10, Downing Street, and next to our cenotaph, our national monument to those that died in two world wars and since. I never thought I'd see these scenes in my country. Well, that is the Islamic call for prayer taking place outside two of our biggest and most important national symbols.
That was Nigel Farage on GB News speaking on a segment titled, Are We Heading to Some Form of Religious War? Now remember, this is all because there were a bunch of people that wanted to stop a close UK ally bombing and killing families. It's ridiculous. But the fear-mongering about Muslims continued, and it was aided by the Speaker of the House of Commons, Lindsay Hoyle.
I never, ever want to go through a situation where I pick up a phone to find a friend of whatever side has been murdered by terrorists. I also don't want another attack on this house. I was in the chair on that day.
Hoyle made that claim after he'd given Keir Starmer a helping hand by quashing a potentially awkward debate on a ceasefire in Gaza. No evidence was provided that such a vote would have risked a terrorist attack, but the media ran with it.
Well, I would like to say to our MPs, how are you going to look your grandchildren in the eye and explain to them that you allowed a problem into Britain, you allowed it to fester, you allowed it to take over, and that you were time and time again too afraid to speak up about it? It's cowards.
That frankly ridiculous idea that Islamists had taken over Britain was also put forward by Suella Braverman in The Telegraph. And after the election of George Galloway in Rochdale, Rishi Sunak spoke at a hastily arranged press conference outside 10 Downing Street.
There are forces here at home trying to tear us apart. Since October the 7th, there have been those trying to take advantage of the very human angst that we all feel about the terrible suffering that war brings to the innocent, to women and children, to advance a divisive, hateful ideological agenda. Yes, you can march and protest with passion. You can demand the protection of civilian life. But no, you cannot call for violent jihad.
Sunak's press conference was ostensibly to announce the government would draw up a new definition of extremism, which would be used to determine which groups could and which couldn't engage with public sector institutions. Michael Gove laid out those details in mid-March.
The proposed definition will hold that extremism is the promotion or advancement of an ideology based on violence, hatred or intolerance that aims to negate or destroy the fundamental rights and freedoms of others, or undermine, overturn or replace the UK system of liberal parliamentary democracy and democratic rights, or intentionally create a permissive environment for others to achieve these results. Organisations such as the Muslim Association of Britain, which is the British affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood, and other groups such as CAGE and MEND, give rise to concern for their Islamist orientation and views. We will be holding these and other organisations to account to assess if they meet our definition of extremism, and will take action as appropriate.
Gove also named two far-right groups in those changes. But with the reforms coming amid a moral panic about pro-Palestine protesters, it's clear who the real target is. So what is driving this new focus on Muslims in Britain? Why do the current crop of Tory leaders appear to have such a problem with certain forms of Islam? And why, from Britain and France to Myanmar and China, do Muslims so often appear to bear the brunt of state repression? To answer these questions, I was joined by Peter Oborne. Peter Oborne is the former chief political commentator at the Daily Telegraph. He's well-versed in both Tory politics and Islam and Islamophobia. And his most recent book is The Fate of Abraham, Why the West is Wrong About Islam. Peter Oborne, thank you so much for joining me on Crash Course.
It's a real pleasure, thank you.
So you've got an interesting history as a journalist, and I suppose also in terms of a political journey that you may have had. So in fact, you start this book with an account of your journey from being an establishment journalist to being an anti-establishment one. Could you talk about that, please, that process that you went through?
Yes, I think it's a question always of whether or not I moved or the rest of the world moved. I mean, if you look, I was a conservative journalist and I had a lot of the most desirable jobs in conservative political journalism. I was the sort of lead political writer, commentator for the Telegraph, for the Mail. I was political editor of the Spectator, or as we, under Boris Johnson, it was still not that political editor then, which is a bit naff. The title, you don't edit anything. I was a political correspondent for the Spectator. And that, you know, that, so there I was in the heart of the conservative, philosophical, political, and journalistic tradition, you know, in the people, the other, you know, I succeeded people in the Spectator, people like Charles Moore or Simon Heffer, etc. Now, the question really is what, whether I moved, as I say, or the Conservative Party moved. And I think that I stayed roughly the same place, i.e. I believed in a traditional kind of Burkean conservatism, which is about great respect for institutions, other cultures. Remember Burke's great war against Warren Hastings, you know, that great trial of accusing him of abuses in India. He favoured Irish, effectively he favoured Irish independence, he favoured American independence, but he warned against the French Revolution because he could see the horrors that it would unleash, which it duly did. And of course, a lot of that kind of wisdom came in Tory warnings against the Iraq War in 2003. And I think that what has happened to the Conservative Party is that it has become captured by the neoconservatives. And neoconservatism is a totally different thing to conservatism. It hates institutions. It hates the rule of law. It hates due process. These are all conservative attributes. And it has a sort of revolutionary dynamic. It has that Marxian belief that the end justifies the means. And so I dare say I have moved, but I haven't moved as much as all of that. And it actually, oddly enough, lands me in a place today where I have much more in common with, say, Jeremy Corbyn or Andrew Feinstein or a lot of, the Muslim Council of Britain than I do with the Conservative Party.
We interviewed Andrew Feinstein on a recent episode of Crash Course on comparisons between Israel, Palestine and apartheid South Africa. Incredibly interesting guy. I'm likely to be standing against Keir Starmer in his constituency at the next general election, I believe. Let's get on to sort of the real meat of the book. So the book's called The Fate of Abraham, and then the subtitle is why the West is wrong about Islam. So from your perspective, what does the West get wrong about Islam?
I started writing this book or researching this book 20 years ago. At the time of the Iraq War, I was so horrified by the ignorance about the Middle East on display, first of all in Afghanistan and then in Iraq and then in Libya, that I did feel it was important to educate myself about the Middle East and also about the great religion of Islam. And so it's been going on now for 1400 years or something, ever since the prophet Islam surged onto the scene in the 7th century AD, common era. And a whole series of tropes and false statements and hatred, actually, of Islam and Muslims. You know, the Crusades, you know, it's just extraordinary, the language you get from the papacy. And you see this long continuity till you get up to people like Bernard Lewis or Michael Gove in the 21st century.
You're writing, so in some way, sort of in response to the Clash of Civilizations thesis, which I think originates with Bernard Lewis, but then it's made much more famous and influential by Samuel Huntington. So could you talk about the Clash of Civilizations narrative? What is it, and why do you think it's wrong?
Put simply, the Clash of Civilizations thesis is that there is this civilization called the West, and then there is rival civilizations which challenge the West and possibly don't have the same wonderful values that the West has in terms of free speech and democracy and all these other great things we have. And there are so many different things which are wrong about the Clash of Civilizations idea. Partly it's a misconception of the West. I mean, if you're going to talk seriously about the West, you have to realize that the West is a history of genocides, particularly of starting out in Africa and across the rest of the world, and then coming into Europe in a most terrible way in the 20th century. It's barbaric in many ways. You know, there's a tremendous continuity between the Crusades, say, which is an early prototype for what happens in the 17th, 18th centuries. It's not to say that there aren't fabulous things and achievements in the West, but it's they have to be properly understood. And that also it fails to understand this thesis, the massive civilizations in the East, which profound, perhaps more so, than Western civilization, and certainly much more ancient. This sort of farcical notion produced by an American professor has driven Western foreign policy for the last 25 years in the most horrible, demented way. And it became a calling card or an inspiration for the neoconservative movement, which has waged permanent war against the rest of the world for the last quarter century. The disastrous conflicts, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and messed up the Middle East in the most terrible or unforgettable, unforgivable ways, led to the deaths beyond computation, and this has been in the name of democracy, and I mean the latest iteration of it, I'm afraid, I think, is what's going on in Gaza at the moment, that somehow Palestinian lives are of little or no consequence. You know, how something very awful is going on at the moment in Gaza. And I think there is an underlying that, particularly I think in the United States, but also in Britain, a kind of racism that people, atavistic contempt for people who aren't white and with blue eyes. And somehow these awful things which happen, awful atrocities in Gaza, happening to people who don't matter.
And you actually have a really interesting chapter on Christian Zionism in the book, and it sort of flipped the order of how I understood American attitudes to Muslims. Because I suppose in reference to Palestine and Gaza, what we're obviously all thinking about a lot at the moment, I had it in my mind that one of the reasons why the Americans don't care that much about Palestinians is because Palestinians are, you know, majority Muslims, and Americans have, to some extent, animus towards Muslims. Right? So I thought it was that order. They don't care about Palestinians because Palestinians are Muslims. Now, what your book sort of suggested, or at least sort of what I got from it, is that actually the order is potentially the other way around, or the causal order. And that's that Christian Zionists, they really care about Israel. The enemy of Israel, the enemy of certain forms of Zionism, are Palestinians. And therefore, the Christian Zionists had an interest in demonizing Palestinians. And it was through the demonization of Palestinians that many Americans gained a hostility to Muslims. So it's not that they don't care about Palestinians because they don't like Muslims. It's they don't like Muslims because they don't like Palestinians. Do you think I'm on the right track there? And also, I suppose, could you talk about that in more general, what you talked about in that chapter on Christian Zionism?
It's one of the things which I took away from it. Of course, you've got to go back to the beginning, really. The Christian Zionism has its origins in the origins of the United States. These heretical Protestant communities coming across from England, being persecuted under Charles I, and landing up in the United States, with very much the idea taken from the Hebrew scriptures, you know, the city on the hill, and Exodus is an extraordinary influence on those early settlers in the United States. And the Holy Bible is the only real book that the American people read, I think, probably for the first 200 years of the history of the United States, of America. And then in the 19th century, we have the evolution of this. I mean, it feels almost insane, actually, Christian Zionism. I mean, all of these movements, these essentially eschatological movements based on interpretations of revelations and the Gospels, to do with the millennium and post-millennial versions of Zionism, pre-millennial. But it all involves Armageddon and the return of Jesus Christ, and it's profoundly anti-Semitic, by the way, paradoxically, Christian Zionism. It needs the Jews to go back to Israel, and somehow that will create the conditions for the Messiah. And it's very fervently believed by tens of millions of Americans, and they who have played an enormous role in the current crisis in the Middle East by giving completely uncritical support to a succession of Israeli leaders.
And I suppose what's also clear in the book, so when I originally thought of Christian Zionism, so, you know, this idea of they want the Jews to go back to Israel so that there can be a second coming of Christ, and I think the true believers then get saved and the Jews will die unless they repent or unless they convert to Christianity, something along those lines. So that to me all sounded quite fringe, you know, and I thought this can't really be something determining American foreign policy, right? But you explain in the book that actually some of the leading evangelical Christian Zionist pastors were incredibly close to, I think, especially Republican presidents, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush. So these were influential people. They weren't just fringe figures. And I suppose I want to put that to you because, you know, I normally think of American foreign policy as being, you know, basically about self-interest, right? So hard-headed realism, protecting American business interests, and then the ideological stuff, sometimes I think of as sort of tagged on at the end, right? It's self-interest and rational self-interest that's determining the foreign policy, and then the ideology basically covers for the interest, because, you know, you want to say you're fighting for a broader cause, not just to help domestic business interests.
Well, a lot of American foreign policy is not hard-headed. For instance, there's nothing hard-headed about the long-standing commitment to unequivocal commitment given by successive presidents to Israel. It's not in the sort of realist interest. It's driven, I think, by these very powerful Christian Zionist lobbies. For instance, the movement of the embassy, American embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is a very significant symbolic act. You've got Christian Zionist pastors there. I mean, for fiercely anti-Semitic, deeply unpleasant people, but they are there alongside at the ceremony, and they're tolerated despite their anti-Semitism, by the Israeli leadership, because their political support is so valuable. I'm sure there are other factors, arms trade, etc., genuine belief in the virtue of the state of Israel, etc., but there's no question this is massively significant.
And there's sort of two types or two claims about clashes of civilizations, I suppose, that are addressed in the book. So one is the supposed clash between Muslims in or Muslim majority countries, let's say, and then Western nations. And then the other is about the existence within Western nations of a large and, you know, normally growing Muslim minority. And it's in the UK where you go into the most detail. And as you can imagine, I'm very much on side with you that there isn't a fundamental clash between Islam and the West, either on the international stage or on the domestic stage, when it comes to Muslims in a majority Christian country anymore. I'm not sure. Agnostic. I'm not sure what
yes.
we are.
We have the ingredients of a very kind of happy multicultural society where all races and religions get on very well. There are all kinds of achievements of post-imperial Britain, which are eagerly being undermined in a very, very, very forceful and ugly way by this current government, without any pushback that one really can see from Labour.
So I definitely agree with you on the overall story. I don't think there is this big clash, sort of big existential clash between Islam and the West, either on the international stage or in the domestic sphere. But I do think there are maybe some tensions that you didn't address in the book. And I suppose one of those that I've seen put out on Twitter recently, and I actually don't know what my answer to it is this. So it's put forward that Islam is the only religion in the UK, or probably across the West, that people are fearful of their lives if they blaspheme against it. So obviously Charlie Hebdo is the most extreme example. They got killed for having published a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. And then more recently in this country, there was a teacher in Batley who had shown his students a picture of the Prophet Muhammad in a conversation about blasphemy, I think. So I think it was a citizenship class or something like that. And there were protests. And as far as I understand, he's now in hiding, you know, 2 or 3 years later. Now, of course, to me, this isn't a reason to say, oh, God, we can't possibly have a large Muslim population in the country because then we'll all have to go into hiding, right? So I don't think that. But it does seem to me that there does exist a tension, right? That is real. It's not purely imagined. So what do you make of that? Do you think that there are some Muslim traditions and practices as they're currently constituted, and some liberal values, sort of the ability, the right to freedom to criticize whatever the hell you want? Do you think there is some tension there potentially?
I think, first of all, that threatening somebody's life is a crime. And anybody who goes around threatening the lives of our fellow citizens should be prosecuted and jailed. The Batley situation was, I'm trying to remember the circumstances, but it was quite complicated. I think the teacher was being quite provocative. I mean, that is not to justify the death threats which were made against him, but it was, you're going to a school which, and I'm talking from memory here, was almost entirely Muslim, and showing very provocative cartoons, was it? Then you, I think you could have just discussed them without showing them. This is all from memory, by the way.
So yeah, just to clarify, yeah. I'm pretty sure he shared the image that Charlie Hebdo had published, sort of not to endorse the image, but to talk about censorship. And so he showed the class that image.
And the Charlie Hebdo, of course, well, the murders of Hebdo would be terrible, but was being set, Hebdo was Islamophobic and deliberately provocative. And actually, I come from a tradition. This is not to defend. I'm not defending the awful atrocities which took place in Paris. But I come from a tradition where you respect each other. I'm an Anglican Christian. I think you should respect each other's religions, each other's sensitivities. And to go out and deliberately and flagrantly insult the leader, the prophet, who is revered by our fellow citizens, is to me a wholly unnecessary and callous act, and I do not accept the idea of unlimited free speech. We have all kinds of barriers to free speech in this country for excellent reasons, partly for community relations. The blasphemy laws, which you talk about, were introduced by the British in 19th century India precisely to avoid community conflagration. And there is a wisdom in that. And we don't insult, we have rules in this country against racial hatred, against stimulating hatred, against all kinds of other things. There's a libel court if you defame somebody personally. So I don't have any problem really in saying, look, we don't have a right to go and burn the Quran or do an. I don't think we do.
That's interesting. So, I mean, the comparison that people make is, say, to the Book of Mormon, right? So you've got this play which is completely rinsing a religious community and a religious minority. Go further back to the tradition of you know, say the life of Brian, which, you know, is again, you know, very mocking of the Christian faith. And I suppose, you know, to me, this still seemed like a bit of an enlightenment idea, right? Where the ability to ridicule a system of beliefs is somewhat sacrosanct. But I suppose what I'm getting from you is you don't see it as sacrosanct. That's a compromise you're happy to live with. You don't think the sort of right to mock religion is incredibly important.
I see it as quite ugly, actually. And I think, in particularly when it comes to minorities in our country, you pick on a minority and you go after the most valuable and valued thing in their whole identity, and you rip it up and you make disgusting cartoons. By the way, the disgusting cartoons about the leader of their religion, I think that's you can say that's satirical and funny, or you can say actually it's barbaric and bullying and cruel and disrespectful. I take the second view.
No, interesting. That's a coherent answer. So another thing that I had questions about in the book was, there are some things that you painted as a bit sinister to me, sort of on the part of the British state, which I wasn't 100% convinced were sinister or even a problem, right? So the one that sort of stood out to me is this. It was about the Research, Information and Communications Unit, so RICU, I think, in the Home Office. And you say they're operating a propaganda war against British Muslims. And then some examples you give. So you say in the run-up to the 2012 Olympics, they funded a documentary about Muslim athletes as an attempt to reduce the chances of a terrorist attack in the Games. And we say they also, you know, funded a Help for Syria campaign to mobilize people on campuses to donate to victims of the civil war. You know, donate to people in Syria, and they thought this could provide people with a way to help Syrians without going there, because they worried that if people went to Syria during the Syrian civil war, they would come back radicalized. Now, with both of these examples, I can see why you might think they were tokenistic or ineffective. I'm not sure a video about Muslims competing in sports is going to do much materially to stop a terrorist attack. But it doesn't seem obviously sinister to me. It doesn't seem necessarily like a propaganda war, as you call it, against Muslims to be trying to promote an idea of Islam that's, where Islam is something that's integral to British society, or whereby you're talking about voluntary ways that one can support people in the Syrian civil war without going there. So I suppose, why did you think of these examples as part of a propaganda war?
Well, what I was, I wasn't particularly going, I mean, those were just examples of organisations which presented themselves to the general public as civil society organisations, which were actually funded, as I recollect, by the Home Office. Now, and there are many other examples which I gave. Now, couldn't that have been done openly? Why were they pretending to? These were very minor cases, by the way, which you rightly point out, and the objectives may well have been benign. Why can't they just be openly say, we are the Foreign Office, we are the Home Office, or whatever it is? Well, it was part of a section of the book which I called The Cold War on British Islam, where I described how the British state, particularly after 7/7, started to went back to the experience of the British state after World War II and the arrival on the scene of the Soviet Union, and there was a secret unit set up within the Home Office with link to the intelligence services and the Foreign Office, which the IRD, the Information Research Unit, which basically funded all kinds of organizations which presented themselves like Encounter magazine as sort of free-thinking organizations independent of the state, were actually financed heavily by the state with political motives and agendas. And at the same time, there was a real sort of surveillance system. I think the problem with the examples you gave is part of a surveillance system which was being secretly carried out, and I think aimed at, I mean, obviously, if people are going to start attacking the state or start our fellow citizens, of course they must be surveilled. But I think there's a problem about surveillance of people's opinions. And that was, and I was very struck that after 7/7 in particular, we got a deliberate attempt to treat British Muslims in the same way as we treated suspected communists or socialists after 1945.
That was the first part of my conversation with Peter Oborne. We cover a lot more in the second part, including Michael Gove's new extremism laws, Peter's positive encounters with the Muslim Brotherhood, some real demystification there, and we discuss our somewhat different approaches to issues surrounding both religion and the state. To listen to the full episode and all previous episodes, you can sign up at patreon.com/crashcoursepod. That's patreon.com/crashcoursepod. Crash Course is produced and edited by Patrick Herdman. You've been listening to Crash Course with Michael Walker. Thank you.